Today on the Human Robot Interaction Podcast, I have with me Sean Welch, one of the very few people who can actually claim that they do have a PhD, a doctorate in philosophy. Sean, welcome.
Thank you, Christoph. I do indeed have a Doctor of Philosophy. I'm not one of these engineers pretending to be philosophers, you know.
This is the Human Robot Interaction Podcast. I am your host, Christoph Bartnick.
Sean, since you are into philosophy, I have to ask you, do you watch The Good Place, the TV show?
Oh, yeah. I love the solution when he goes for all six on the trolley problem. Everybody gets the same treatment, death for everybody. It's very egalitarian.
So whoever hasn't seen The Good Place, go and check it out. It's an amazing show. Sean, today we're here to talk about ethics and robots. And of course, the first question then is, what on earth is ethics?
Ah, well, that's a very simple question. It's the classification of actions and states as right or wrong, full stop, the end. When you're talking about robots or ethics or humans, I don't really care, you know, whether it's a robot doing right or wrong or a human doing right or wrong. A robot will do something and people will say, that's right, that was a right thing to do, or that was a wrong thing to do. So if you tell a robot to make a cup of tea and it makes you a cup of coffee, well, the robot did wrong. If you tell the robot to stop the bad guys from killing us and the robot said, come on in, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, kill them all, yes, 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 then the robot did wrong. So really it's about right and wrong in the moral sense, as distinct from right and wrong in the logical sense, which is, you know, truth and falsity. So moral right and moral wrong is the essence of what ethics is. Of course, I've just answered the question by saying it's about morality. So it's a bit circular. But most people in everyday language do understand right and wrong, and that's the core. The other thing you need to consider is good and bad. So good and bad is like an evaluation, whereas right and wrong is kind of like a moral conclusion. And whether somebody, you tend to try, you want your things to, agents to do good and not to do bad. And that leads you to ought, which is a modal verb which talks about action. You know, you ought to do things that give you good outcomes and that's right. And you ought not do bad things which lead to bad outcomes and that's wrong. So that's, you know, you need five things in ethics is usually about right, wrong, good, bad, and ought are the five core vocabulary items that any ethical discussion will have. You can have a lot more, of course. You can talk about virtues, vices, character traits, etc., etc. But fundamentally, it's about classification of action and states as right or wrong.
But ethics, of course, didn't start with robots. Ethics started thousands of years ago, and people have been thinking and talking about it for thousands of years.
They have indeed.
There must have been an enormous amount of work done in this area. So can you walk us through some of the major ideas there?
Sure. How many years was this podcast going to go? But if you begin at the beginning with, say, the seven religions of civilization, four. So you have Jewish ethics, there is a God. God made the world. He also created the knowledge of good and evil, which he gave to Adam and Eve. So you have the basic things already. There's good, there's bad, and there's the knowledge of good and bad. And the knowledge of good and evil is ethics, so to speak. And in the beginning, Adam and Eve had no idea what good and bad was. They were walking naked in the Garden of Eden. They had no guilt, no shame, no pride, no joy. I don't know what they were doing. It's a little obscure, but they were, you know, eating. And then along comes a snake and an apple. You get the knowledge of good and evil, and you get conscience and guilt and shame, and all that stuff comes into being. So that kind of theory is called divine command theory. There's a God, and God says, this is right and this is wrong. Thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do that. And that's also known as deontology. So you base your morals on duties. You know, you have a duty to honor your father and mother. You have a duty not to steal and commit murder and covet thy neighbor's goods, etc. Another kind of ethics is like utilitarianism, which is based on the greatest happiness principle, which is, you know, you should do whatever makes people happy, generally speaking. Then there's virtue ethics, which is basically Aristotle, and virtue ethics says you should cultivate a set of virtues like, say, courage or wisdom or poverty, chastity, and obedience if you're Aquinas, courage, liberality, and magnificence if you're Aristotle. The different virtue ethicists have different virtues. So you get, you know, the big three in moral theory in the West are basically utilitarianism, deontology, and virtue ethics. Obviously, you have other religions. Confucianism is more about social order and harmony. Taoism is more about going with the flow and being natural. Buddhism is sort of abstaining from desire. And so on, all these schools, which are millennia old, have various positions. But they all manage to agree that you shouldn't murder, you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't rape, you should be nice to mum and dad. All of the major religions do actually have common ground. While people think there's endemic disagreement in ethics, and that's true, there's also a lot of agreement. It's not the case that everybody argues about everything. It's just that the sum of the differentiator issues get argued about.
I guess the problem is that if this has been debated for thousands of years and heated debate, and even though there might be some agreement, the problem, of course, would be now, if you have to teach ethics to a robot, then which one are you going to pick? Which one of all of many ideas, of all those different approaches, would be the most suitable one for implementing it into a robot?
Well, let's suppose we're going to ship our robot to Christchurch on the South Island of New Zealand. I will answer that question very clearly. You will program that robot or train out robots to obey and do whatever will stand up in the Timaru Magistrates Court. Like, it's the law of New Zealand, and that will get you through all the serious stuff. So the don't murder, don't rape, don't kidnap, don't commit arson, da-di-da-di-da. That will get you through a large chunk of morality with absolutely no controversy because it's the law of the land. So that gets you maybe a third or a quarter of your ethics done. There are some people who insist that law and ethics are not related. I think that's silly, but some people do make a distinction. So I basically will just glob ethics as right and wrong, and a subset of ethics will be legal, and that's stuff that the state takes an interest in. So what's legal is, this is the state is saying, like, say, supposing, for example, you're Jewish and you don't want to eat pork. The state says, fine, you can be Jewish, don't eat pork. We don't care. We're not going to ban pork because you don't like it. Pork is still legal in New Zealand, but if you're Jewish, you have the choice. You can say, I will not have pork in my house. Fine. If you're vegan, no pork, no fish, whatever. Law is when the state says this is right and wrong. And ethics can have a broader meaning, what individuals say is right and wrong. But the robot still has to do the legal stuff. And then as to, the more detailed question. So if it's in New Zealand, it must obey New Zealand law. If it's in Sean's house, and Sean is a gourmet cook who's into French cuisine and Thai cuisine, absolutely everything is on the menu. But if the robot was in the rabbi's house, well, pork is not on the menu, and oysters Kilpatrick is definitely not on the menu because that's doubly damned. So, that kind of lower level detail law or norm can be, you'd have to have variation for these cases where ethics differs from house to house.
But then this would imply then that a robot needs to actually fully understand the law in how it is written. And I would assume that there is a considerable amount of ambiguity in some of the laws that are written. So
yes,
how do we get around that?
That's probably the most challenging point of robot ethics. So what the lawyers talk about, so the law doesn't tell you everything, right? The lawyers make appeal to concepts like the meaning of the word, the natural meanings of the statute, precedent in cases where the statute doesn't actually say anything.
Well, how about what a normal, reasonable person would expect?
Exactly. The reasonable person, right? So that is where the law, that is the universal fill in the gaps of the law, is what would the reasonable person do in these circumstances? And that's about 9/10 of the law, is the interpretation of the reasonable person. Because there isn't a law. Supposing you come up, I think of a trolley problem. What if there are two monkeys, six Persian cats, and an ape on the three branches of the line? Which one do I decide to kill? Well, there's no law which answers that question. You have to say, well, the reasonable person would maybe not care, so kill the least amount of animals or prefer the cats over the whatever. But the reasonable person is like this sort of polyfiller that fills in all the gaps between the statutes. And reproducing that in AI, I think, would be extraordinarily difficult. And that, I think, is the huge challenge for AI and robotics, is to come up with this reasonableness.
But that kind of digs into the question then, what kind of prerequisites do we have to fulfill for a robot to make ethical decisions? So filling in or understanding a reasonable person, okay, that's a big one.
Yep.
What other kind of information or abilities does a robot need to be able to make ethical decisions?
Basically, the way I tackle the problem is I split ethics up. I don't try, some people like try and solve ethics with like what I call one line of code. So, you know, Jeremy Bentham says that the principle of utility, and that's, you know, basically John Stuart Mill says it's acts are right insofar as they tend to promote happiness, wrong insofar as they tend to promote unhappiness. And Bentham breaks this down into how long the happiness is, how intense the happiness is, and blah, blah, blah. So you have a pretty much one line, the happiness does everything, and that's Bentham's data model. I don't think that's an adequate data model for ethics, and it's over the years people have sort of pointed out the bugs in Bentham's data model, so to speak. So to me, it's a more complex algorithm, but I don't think it's insoluble. It's not solved yet. I mean, to look at a historical perspective, right now I think we're like, compared to, say, longitude. Now, longitude, as you know, the famous problem of longitude at sea was regarded as insoluble for 200 years. You know, the King of Spain said, here's a pile of money, solve it. Nobody solved it. Another King of Spain said, here's another pile of money, solve it. Tuscan Duke said, solve it, Leonardo da Vinci. And Galileo had a go, but didn't quite solve it, but got a little bit of money. And so you get on to the 1800s, and there's this huge Navy disaster, and half the Royal Navy sinks, and the British say, longitude, huge grand challenge, please, somebody solve longitude. And yet when Jonathan Swift was writing Gulliver's Travels in 1820s, and here we are in the 2020s or 1720s, he thought it was a joke. Anybody who thought they could discover the longitude was obviously some quack, fraud, fake idiot. And I think that's where we are. But history shows by the 1760s, longitude was solved. By the time Captain Cook gets to New Zealand on his second voyage, he's got a marine chronometer, he's got almanacs, he's got two solutions to longitude, not one. One is the astronomical method, which Galileo Galilei started on. The other is the method of keeping a true GMT time with two clocks. Both of those worked, as it turns out, you know. So I think within 40 or 50 years, we'll probably get there, but it would require a huge research effort.
But that would be very much on the idea of being able to reason about, I suppose, ethics. But one of the problems I guess we also need to address is that a robot's knowledge about the world, one of the problems that we have in robotics is that robots really don't usually know what's going on in the world, right? No. They don't know where they are, you know, who they are, where they're supposed to go, who's in front of me, what, you know, so there's a lot of sensory data that tries to get in, but this data is not necessarily rich. As when a robot has a camera, it doesn't mean that they can see in the same way that humans can see.
No.
Are you assuming that robots will have full and complete knowledge of the world around them?
So how I approach a problem is, you've got a problem, let's say it's a good old-fashioned trolley problem that we talked about earlier. So the decision is you have the runaway trolley. You're standing by the switch. If you do nothing, five people die in one tunnel. If you throw the switch, one person dies in the second tunnel. What do you do? I say, right, what information do you need to solve that problem and that problem alone? And you need to come up with a value for human life. You need to come up with a value for throwing the switch. And is there anything else you care about? And the answer is not a lot. It's a fairly straightforward 5-to-1. That problem is called switch and is very famous. Then you come to the related problems, which are hospital, where you have the super surgeon who can kill one and save five. Well, what's the difference between hospital and switch? Is there a difference? If so, does that change the 1-5 decision? And the answer I would say is yes, there are differences there. And similarly, the one with the fat guy on the footbridge and you push the fat guy and he stops the trolley. How is that different to throwing the thing? So, I mean, philosophers argue about these things, but to me, the main difference between those scenarios is risk assumption. So that if you are trying to minimize damage in a situation where everybody has freely assumed risk as responsible for own life, you can distinguish that 1-to-5 case from the 1-to-5 case where some people haven't assumed risk, they're just minding their own business, and all of a sudden they get dragged into this scenario and thrown into it bodily or have their organs harvested. So you can distinguish on the grounds of risk assumption and innocence and fairness. So you have to start using that kind of concept. And these are qualitative concepts. That's where it gets difficult for robots, because robots are much better at quantitative concepts and sets and logic. But you can reason with qualitative concepts, but again, it will be difficult to define a concept of innocence. But you can ask a simple question, did the agent assume risk, true or false? That, at least at the human level, gives us a way to start this work. But again, I say this is a, you know, a 40 or a 50 year project. I think this is like discovering morality, so to speak, is like discovering longitude. It's harder than longitude. Longitude actually is a really simple problem. You just need to know what time it is based on a clock. If it's in the sky or in the palm of your hand, you don't care where the clock is. It's the same solution. You just need to know what is the time now at a point, fixed point of reference, and what is the time local noon, and you do the math and you're done. Morality, there's a lot more variables involved.
But this is, I guess, the point I was getting at, is that when everything is known, when you exactly know that this path, five are killed, this path, one is killed, you can indeed make decisions.
Yes.
But one of the problems in robotics is that very often you do not know. You don't know what's down that track, and you don't know what's down that track, and you have essentially incomplete information about the world, or even an incomplete understanding of certain concepts of the world.
That's right.
So my question to you is, will it be your prerequisite for robots to have all of these things clarified? Do they need to know everything about everything, and then they can make the decision? Or is there a way that they could already make decisions without complete knowledge about the world?
I use a concept in my research, what I call all things represented. So if you can give me a situation report, and you say, here's a report which tells me everything that's going on in terms of logic. So, you know, the trolley cannot stop. I can throw the switch, everything is represented in logic. And that's the deal. That's a little bundle of stuff. Then yes, I can answer that question. But if you're saying, can I send a robot out into the open world where brand new things might happen, where it's not a switch, it's not a train line, it's a trapeze and a spike. There's so much. What humans are very good at is assessing what's good and bad, because we have these pleasure and pain circuits in our bodies. And this is things that Bentham is very strong on. You know, nature has said, two things govern us, pleasure and pain, and they rule ought, and good and bad comes down to pleasure and pain. We have these built-in circuits, which robots, we don't have hedonic circuits for robots. And a large, huge amount of what's considered reasonable is involved in pleasure-pain calculations. But also there's things like disgust, there's things like anger, there's things like interests. Like if I, harm your interests, that will be seen as wrong or aggressive. There's many, many, it's not just, the difference in time, but like longitude, there's dozens and dozens of these really important fundamental concepts, all of which have to be represented, because all of them might be relevant in a particular moral case. Like I said, huge project, but, given time, and I'm thinking decades, I think it's a soluble project.
So how is this decision-making about ethics different from other forms of decision-making? So if you task a robot with, get me a beverage or, clean my dishes, the robot has to come up with a plan, has to make decisions and so forth.
Yep.
Is that in any way different from making ethical decisions?
No, that is an ethical decision. It's not a very interesting ethical decision. It's a little ethical decision, right? It's like if I tell the robot, clean the dishes. Now, that is a moral command. It's not, it's every day. But this is the point I'd like to stress. The vast majority of everyday morality is not remotely controversial. The rabbi, the priest, the guru, the imam, none of these people are going to argue about the robot should stack the dishes when the dishes are dirty, dinner is finished, everybody's put their knives together. Maybe there's a bit of variation on these details. But the basic case of should the robot stack the dishwasher when dinner is done and the human says, please stack the dishwasher, everybody's going to be cool. The Jews, the Buddhists, everybody says, yeah, that's fine. We're fine with the robot doing that. Nobody's going to argue about that decision. So that's a really easy moral decision because no one argues. That's what you start with, because people will buy that and they won't argue about it. So from a commercial point of view, designing your robot to do the morally obvious is far more sensible than worrying about, the daughter of the house says, and she's 15 and three quarters and she's pregnant. And she asks the robot, should I get an abortion? You might think, the robot should just be like Stevens in The Remains of the Day and say, I regret I'm unable to be of assistance, Samantha. Talk to your mother. the robots can duck the hard stuff, but and just do the, clean the floor, make the bed, put on the laundry, make sure the white clothes are white and the delicates are delicate and the colors are colored and, do all that stuff. This is all easy peasy. Well, actually, it's not easy peasy, as you know. Laundry is actually quite hard for robots, but from a moral perspective, nothing challenging there at all.
So what then are the real challenges in making ethical decisions?
The real challenge is getting the humans to agree on what's ethical. As you would know, different jurisdictions have different laws. So, you know, in New Zealand, you can eat pork and drink cider, and indeed you can even engage in some acts which are illegal elsewhere, like you can go to a house of ill repute. It's perfectly legal in New Zealand and the Netherlands, but it's very illegal in other places like most of America and so on. So you have this moral variation between what is and is not okay. So you can start off with what's not okay and what is okay everywhere, but then you focus on, well, if there's variation and its significance, then you have to deal with some localization. But this is exactly what big software projects do all the time anyway. I mean, if you download the Oracle database and you're in Saudi Arabia, you'll want the Arabic interface and you'll check some boxes and saying, I want the, you know, I want the Arabic language and maybe I want the Muslim moral code, like Muslim specific rules because I'm in a Muslim jurisdiction. And so you can have that stuff. But there'll be this core universal morality that everybody's don't kill, don't murder, don't steal, don't rape, don't kidnap, don't da 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 da, that all the religions and all the ethicists will agree on a lot. So I think we overestimate the problem of moral variation. And you can get a lot done if you focus on the moral common ground.
Mm. So one of the questions, I guess, that comes up is about autonomy.
Yeah.
Because if I program the robot to do something, is it then actually my morality that I implement to the robot? Is the robot actually then just executing my code? Or is the robot actually making its own decision? And is actually the autonomy to be able to make your own decision a requirement to make ethical decisions at all? Because otherwise you would just essentially be playing back a record.
I'm fine with saying, let's suppose that I'll choose my design because I know it intimately. So the code that I would write for a robot, it's absolutely Sean Welch's moral code is in that robot. That robot is just a clone of my cognition. It's a subset of my cognition. It's been tested on particular cases and it's sort of certified to work on, you know, about 70 test cases. It's very much a beginning of a long voyage. So I'm fine to say that that robot is not autonomous in the sense that a human being is autonomous. It's autonomous in that the robotic sense usually is like, say, George Becky's definition of autonomy is just no human operator. So the human is not saying, oh, here's the trolley, what do I do? The robot says, ah, I recognize this problem, looks it up in its database and goes, the solution is blah. I have a data model. I have a decision procedure. I follow the rules and I apply the algorithm. It works, hopefully. I would not attribute responsibility to that robot at all, right? That's, maybe that's Sean Welch's responsibility or the company that's hiring Sean Welch. I would suggest there should be some kind of insurance scheme to manage this liability, and there almost certainly will be because this is what's happening in autonomous vehicles. The big car companies are writing insurance packages with their insurers and they're just going to, you know, deal with it that way. But yeah, to me, until you get a robot that's got being with a capital B and has feelings of its own and has genuine interests of its own and a self, like it actually has a phenomenally conscious self, I don't see how you could make that morally responsible for anything. It's just an artifact that does what it's a puppet on a string, and Sean wrote the strings. Even if it's training data, it's like a puppet on it's a puppet on a puppet on a string, in that the training data was put into the robot to this little neural net, which is one of my puppets that gives me a moral a right-wrong classification. I'm still responsible for the training data. I'm still responsible for that particular design of neural net. Was it fit for purpose? Did I train it right? Blah, 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 blah. So to me, the robot's got a long way to go before it becomes responsible like a human does. And we just don't understand what makes humans morally responsible. And we certainly don't know how to build that in robots yet.
A person like a programmer would potentially want to push away the responsibility with the argument saying, look, I've built this piece of software and it is designed to some degree deal with phenomena or sensory data it has not encountered before. I mean, that's the idea of machine learning. It's like you are able to deal with something that you haven't seen before. And if you put a robot into the real world, the complexity of the world is so enormous. There's no possible way that you can predict how the robot will act in every possible situation.
Yep.
And therefore, you would argue, look, I cannot take responsibility because I really, I don't, I even, I do not know how the robot is going to react out there.
Very hard for you to ship it in that case. I mean, really. I mean, I think this is what the autonomous vehicles community are struggling with at the moment, right? I mean, it's like Pareto principles within Pareto principles. So, you know, it's like 20% of the code will solve 80% of the traffic. Then you've got that next 20% of the unsolved. So you write another 20% of code will solve 80% of that. Then you get down to like, you know, 2%. So you get to this, and finally you get to this wafer thin edge of, you know, the total weird one in a million, one in 10 million day miles occurrences, which humans can just deal with because our ability to sort of put together threats and opportunities is like, snap, we've got 4 billion years of survive on the face of planet Earth biological code running. We know about danger. Like, we do. We're very good at spotting threats and opportunities. Computers have to be explained all this stuff in logic and maths. And this is really hard. So, you know, in many ways, computers are absolutely hopeless at this stuff. So, yeah, I'll accept that it's hugely difficult. And, you know, there are some people starting to get pessimistic about whether AVs will ever, whether they'll ever get to level 5 autonomy. People are saying there's always going to have to be a guy, you know, on the wheel. Like, no wheel autonomy requires a controlled environment, which is, you know, what is the case when you go to airports and there's no driver in it. It's, there's a train line and it has a beginning and an end. It is simply not physically possible for it to get off the train line. So it might be that it is impossible and doesn't become possible.
So I recently saw this news item, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, that Tesla announced that their autopilot can now detect and deal with traffic cones.
Well, well done, Tesla. About time, you might say. That's a bit late. They've had cars on the road for how many years in New South Wales and Christchurch, which can't recognize traffic cones? You'd be going, oh, my Lord, England. I mean, England. I remember there was an old German joke that was told, because, you know, the Germans have much better roads than the British. And a snotty motoring journalist from Germany said of the English motorways, I wish to meet the daughter of the man who makes the traffic cones on the English motorways.
Well, I mean, the point being here is that we dare to put cars on the roads right now who are unable to deal with traffic cones, and we still do that. And I found this case also with the Uber accident last year quite interesting in the sense that they had built-in code that they accepted the fact that the car would encounter situations where it wouldn't know what to do. It couldn't make sense of it.
Yep.
But if they would hit the brakes every time, the car would go nowhere because it would stop just far too often. So they put in a certain tolerance for uncertainty where you just go with the flow, you know, because hitting brakes is also quite dangerous for you might actually cause an accident.
It's true. Yeah.
But who decides on that particular threshold? I mean, that's a very dangerous decision to make.
That's a pretty acute tuning problem, to use the jargon. How do you tune that parameter to get you effective driving that's better than human safety standards? I think the main problem with the AVs is that, as you say, because there's this sort of hollowness in them, in that they're just shuffling cymbals in a Turing machine at the end of the day. And sure, they can do it very fast and they can do it very well and they cannot lose any data. They still have this basic lack of like what you might call spatial, phenomenal, pain, pleasure, perceiving threat. What's really going to be a problem is a balloon, you know, floating across going to be, is that something you break for? And most people don't break for balloons. Most people don't break for bugs. They don't even break. They might try and swerve to avoid a bird. Kid on a motorbike, you'd hit the brakes. So it's distinguishing between these various objects in your sensor field that are going to be a trouble. And I think this was after dark and the light was bad and the route might have been occluded or something.
actually get more interesting because as far as I read up on it recently, one of the problems they had is that they had built-in perception of people, but those were only active when they would approach situation like a crossing where you would expect people to be. But the person that crossed the road was doing it at a place where you would not expect normally to people to cross the road.
Oh, well, the person deserves to die. He's acquired assumed risk and died. I would kill him, that's pretty harsh. But no, I think obviously that's not a realistic assumption. If you are crossing the road in a place that is so dangerous, that is really silly if it was humans driving, like, you know, close to a sharp bend and somebody's traffic whizzes around this bend quite routinely and there's a cliff on the other side and there's nowhere for anybody to go except to flatten you because they can't swerve off the road because they'll kill themselves. If you cross the road somewhere crazy, there does come a point where my sympathy does start to evaporate. But in that, not actually knowing where it was, if it's sort of a, you know, jaywalking on a motorway where you have fences or something like that, well, I can see why the car wasn't primed to expect that. But the thing is, humans do crazy stuff. This is the Pareto, you know, the 20-20-20, like once you get into the third or the fourth Pareto slice, after you've gotten to 80%, you know, I got 80% of my stuff done, then I get another 16% done, and then I get, we get down to the last point, 0.1%, when people are driving the wrong way up the expressway, they're on the wrong side of the road. And they don't have flashing lights. You know, the police can drive on the wrong side of the road and do, but there are some cases which just humans just get, that's weird, but I'm just going to pull over to one side of the road and let this mad guy who's on the wrong lane going in the wrong direction on the one-way street, I'm just going to get out of his way. That's really hard. But I don't know. I mean, obviously, when they have these errors, then the programmers will go back to the drawing board and say, okay, how do we elegantly deal with this? And maybe they soften that tuning and recognize people in crazy places better than they do. And I think there'd be a bit of cost-cutting going on as well. I don't think that's some...
The underlying question, I guess, is there is the idea or the difference between a strong AI and a weak AI where... Well, I guess I'll ask you about a definition of that. And my follow-up question would then be, do we need to have a strong AI for a robot to make ethical decisions?
I sort of define AI as automated human intelligence. So I prefer to speak of a HI rather than AI, because I think talking about AI makes it an alien. It's like this weird Skynet type thing in the wings. And then because it's automated, you can accelerate it. But the other thing as well, because it's automated, it's a subset. So AI is really an automated, accelerated subset of human intelligence. It does some things very fast, but they're not the complete package of human intelligence. So if you mean by strong AI something that's like at the human intelligence level, then I'd say, well, if you want to assign moral responsibility to the AI, then yeah, it sort of has to have being. Maybe it has to have hedonic circuits. Maybe it has to have moral emotions like guilt and pride and shame and joy, which have evolved in Homo sapiens over a long time, and which promotes, you know, pro-social cooperation, so the biologists and psychologists will tell us. So If that's what you mean, and your bar for moral is set at human levels, then yes, I'd agree with that. But personally, in my own work, I work with very weak AI. I work with almost common and garden software level, and I use closed world assumptions. You know, I just say, well, all I'm trying to do is get some clarity about a generic data model and decision procedure, which will enable a right-wrong decision in fairly black and in concrete cases. My theory is I'll pick a concrete case, a concrete case, a concrete case. And you'll notice I'm not diving straight for the Uber with the passenger I'm not sure, the pedestrian I'm not sure is a pedestrian type case. I'm doing, you know, classic problems of moral philosophy and things that I'd say are morally obvious, like, you know, should the robots empty the bedpan for the sick guy in the bed who can't get to the toilet? You know, it's like, oh, yes, of course he should, but why should he do that? And you have to explain to the robot why this is good and why not doing it will have these consequences which are bad. And so you get this sort of agent, patient, action state, valued state, disvalued state. You get all that logic happening, and then you can make moral decisions. But at the moment, I'm definitely in, you know, a closed world. And I'm definitely not pretending that I know how to make strong AI. I don't think anybody knows how to make it yet. So I can say you can get a limited degree of moral functionality out of weak AI, but I don't think you'd get human-level moral functionality out of weak AI. But I think we can get, an idea of how to solve the problem. You know, we can say, yes, it's about time. But, it might be about needs, wants, interests, fairness, whatever that is. A lot of the literature in AI and fairness at the moment. So you've got to get greater clarity on exactly what these things are. And then you can try and automate them. But, I mean, we're still arguing about them as humans yet. So the thrust of my work is to try and use AI to clarify the human debate and at least get the humans singing from the same song sheet with respect to a requirements spec for a moral robot. So I think we need to get that basic requirements specification done before we can go around to solution design and development and all the rest of it and start actually shipping moral robots.
Well, I guess the AVs are of such particular interest right now because of the severeness of the impact. I mean, if your robot doesn't fill the dishwasher with dishes or doesn't understand to do a certain household chore, the consequences are not that dramatic. But if you talk about AVs, well, people do get killed. And I guess this is why the decision around ethics is so focused right now on AVs. It's a kind of a real, I think, first example where you've got robots in the wild, not in the lab, not in a controlled environment, out in the world, doing things that can potentially harm people. I mean, we had, of course, let's say, airplanes. I mean, they've been running on autopilot for years, right? It's not like we never had autonomy.
No.
But it is definitely getting there.
I think some things are more autonomizable, if you will, than others. So I think navigation, particularly in the air, where you have, anti-collision systems in radar, which have been around, since World War II, for crying out loud. So that kind of avoid collisions and get where I want to go, which is essentially all AV ethics is avoid collisions and get from A to B. That's it. And maybe, do it at the right speed and pick the shortest route. It's not a morally hard thing. It's a technically hard thing to sort of decide when to brake to avoid some of these things which are hard to classify. So it's more a sensing problem than a moral problem. So I don't see AVs as actually being, they're a challenge in that we know, like everybody will agree on what's the right thing to do on the road, right? I mean, there's rules, there's case law, there's precedent, there's the rules of the road tell you when to give way, what speed you can drive, when you can overtake, yada, yada, yada. There isn't much moral controversy about driving. It's the execution of that existing morality, which is pretty obvious, that's hard. So that's an example where it's not the morality that's difficult, it's the technology that does the sensing and the deciding. It's the sensing that's hard and the actuating is hard. The cognition, I think, is straight. Well, the cognition that does the sensory classification is hard. But it's not actually a moral rule or principle problem.
Right. So what I hear you say is that, again, if an autonomous vehicle or a robot has perfect data around the world, and it does have a perfect rule book in terms of this is what you're supposed to do, making the decision is reasonably easy.
Straightforward enough.
Yeah. So the problem then really is sensing and acting in the world. Would that be fair to say?
Well, but with the AV case, I'd say sensing is definitely the main problem because, if the AV had classified that object as a human with greater probability or above what, then it would presumably have hit the brakes and the human wouldn't have died for whatever reason. Apparently, it didn't, or I think it changed its mind, and it said, the classifier reclassified the same sensor data, or similar sensor data, because obviously as the car gets closer, the data changes. So it sort of had this flip-flop. So yeah, to me that's a sensing or classification problem rather than a moral problem. I mean, moral problems are a certain kind of classification. They're a subset of classification, but they're not classifying about whether it's human or not. It's classifying good, bad, right, wrong, type classification is moral. The mere, are you wearing a blue shirt? I'm not saying that might be relevant. If there's a battle and the red coats are fighting the blue coats, well, it's a targeting relevance, but in everyday, it's not really moral, but it's a classification.
It almost sounds to me like you are saying that any kind of decision making is moral decision making.
Pretty much, yeah, absolutely. I I've had meetings with neuroscientists who'll tell you it's morality all the way down, right down to the spine, you know. Everything in the brain has got some low level of moral functionality. So even the correct classification of an object as human or balloon, that does potentially have moral impact if you're going to hit it and if what you're driving is deciding whether or not to brake or swerve. So yeah, even a classification decision in the right context becomes moral. Often you think it's so obvious. This isn't morality. I'm not having an argument about it. Just because you're not having an argument doesn't... Just imagine, well, what if you do the opposite? And if what you do the opposite, even though you think, well, who would do that? It's still moral if you can... If the robot, right, could just decide, no, I need to recharge now. It's more important than your dishes. Meh. That might be fine. Or it might say, no, I'm going to not going to do your dishes at all because, you know, I learned something today. I read Google and I learned something and now it's morally advantageous for humans to do their own dishwashers. It's more economically sustainable or something. So if you want that robot in your house, don't think you'd be able to sell that one. But
that means essentially that every robot we already have
is doing something moral.
Is doing something moral.
Let's take very long established robots. So the ones that are on automobile production lines, which drill screws in holes. A human might put the wrong screw in the wrong hole. The reason we get the robots to do it is they can't put the wrong screw. It's very difficult. You know, something has to go. A sensor, maybe if a sensor fails or there's a blowout or the firmware goes foots because of a power surge, yes, it can go wrong. But 999 times out of 1,000, the robot just puts that right screw with the right number of torque, the right screw, the right time, the right place. It just gets it right and perfect every time, whereas the human gets bored, starts dreaming about the weekend, starts chatting with the guy in the next line. They miss it. They have to stop the line, go back and re-drill. That's why automation replaces humans a lot on production, because a lot of this stuff is boring. Even as with the best will in the world, you don't want a job on a automobile assembly line because it's just menial, repetitive, boring Adam Smith work. You know?
Because when we talk about ethics and robots, we think about Asimov, we think about all this great moral dilemmas mm-hmm. and everything, and we don't really bother about these kind of day-to-day activities at all. So...
Shh, don't tell anybody, it's my differentiator. So basically, I think this is a huge mistake. So let me give you an analogy. So I used to work for a political staffer for a politician in Australia. And I went to Canberra and I acted as the guy who wrote his minutes and put out his press releases saying, that other mob are a bunch of galahs who under no circumstances should win government in 300 words or less every day. That was my job, putting out a press release. And I went into Parliament and I went to Prime Minister Question Time. Now, that's the most heavily reported hour in the week is Question Time. If you get the impression from Question Time that there's continuous argument, it's all shame, or yeah. You know, it's a complete bun fight, often, particularly when the question is about something lively. So it's always the opposition questions that are lively. It's never the government questions. The government questions are just, here's a nice little easy question, Minister. We want you to beat up the opposition with it. So you get the impression from this hour that it's all about fighting. But what is actually true is 80% of government bills, 80%, 4 out of 5, go through on a quorum because nobody's arguing about them. So 80% of the laws just pass. You know, the chief opposition whip meets with the chief whoop and the manager of government business and opposition business to say, do we want to argue about this? You know, it's the reform of the Drains Act or something. we'll give it, 2 minutes of debate time. And they just agree on so much. So this perception that we're always fighting about morality is a bit of an illusion. It's not actually true in politics, even though the journalists... Because they want a story. And in a story, you've got to have a fight. You've got to have a drama. You've got to have a conflict. So there's this narrative perception of morality, which is centered on the storyteller's need for a conflict. If you actually count morality like a statistician, you wake up in the morning and say, well, I'm going to log all my moral decisions. I promised that I'd be here at 2:30. You know, tick, I'm here at 2:30. I was a good lad. Any drama there? I was a bit worried about getting a park. There was only one park left because I don't have a sticker anymore. I forgot about that. when I actually go through my day of all the moral things that I do, which if I did the opposite would be wrong, and I don't even seriously think. It's only because I did this PhD in robot ethics. I thought, well, what if I did the opposite? Said, oh, yeah, that'd be bad. I could park in the wrong place. I could park, you know, in the middle of the road. There's all these possibilities I could do, but just don't enter my mind. So the morally obvious is kind of a powerful place to start with robot ethics, because the robots have to learn the morally obvious before they get to the morally contentious.
I guess that's good news for you roboticists out there. Ethics is not difficult to do.
Easy as pie.
Thank you so much, Sean.
No worries. Thanks, Christoph.